welcome to the Semiconductor Insiders Podcast Series. The goal of this podcast is to bring semiconductor experts together to get to the truth about the matter at hand. We'll get right to the point and not exceed 30 minutes of your time. If you have a topic you would like us to cover, please post it on semiwiki.com and we'll get right to it. Okay, let's talk about Intel's IDM 2.0 and their venture back into the foundry business. With me today is Dr. Walden Rhines. Wally is widely recognized as an expert in business value creation and technology for the semiconductor and electronic design automation industry. Good morning, Wally.
Good morning, Daniel. How are you?
Real good, real good. Great topic. A lot of people are talking about it. So let's get started. But first, in your opinion, Wally, why did Intel's previous attempt at the foundry business fail?
Well, I've talked to lots of customers, people at Intel and others. I think the single biggest thing is that they went into it as a manufacturing business, and I believe foundry is really a service business. So the things that are so important to foundry are things like flexibility and responsiveness and many things that are contrary to all the disciplines that made Intel great. The manufacturing is all about controlling variability and being rigid, and Intel had a focus with very little diversity of process, very rigid manufacturing controls, and those are all the opposite things you see in a company like Taiwan Semiconductor.
Yeah, you know, customer collaboration is also pretty important. And, you know, let's face it, Intel is an IDM foundry like Samsung. That's different than a pure play foundry. So what really has changed? You know, what's different now that Intel thinks that they can get back into the foundry business?
Well, I have the utmost respect for Pat Gelsinger. He certainly knows what he's doing. And I think they look forward and see that the world is going to a point where process development is extremely expensive and amortizing it over your own base of production is getting less and less viable. And so they're seeing it as a way to stay as an integrated device manufacturer. I think also, as they look forward, they realize that the U.S. politically is very concerned about the lack of leading edge semiconductor manufacturing capability in our country, within our borders, or at least out of the range of China. And so I think Intel probably believes they will be a prime beneficiary of whatever it is that the U.S. government does to encourage local manufacturing.
Oh, I agree. How's Intel going to give customers the confidence that their design information will remain confidential? You know, they are an IDM foundry. They do compete with their customers, maybe on occasion. And, you know, if you look back with Samsung, the other IDM foundry, they clearly had issues with Apple and other customers that they turned around and ended up competing with.
Yeah, that's historically been an issue all the way back to the early days. UMC and TSMC had different strategies, even though Morris Chang was CEO of both. The UMC approach was to produce their own products, mostly ROMs and static RAMs, whereas TSMC was unique in that it did not produce any of its own designs. And it maintained that discipline, and that built confidence with customers. When Samsung came back into the foundry business, that was raised as a concern, and Apple clearly was sensitive to that. But there, Apple competed directly with Samsung as one of the few leading manufacturers of cell phones, so that kind of competition was pretty much in your face. I think for most foundry customers, the products that Intel produces are not that directly competitive. And I think management like Pat and others will be very sensitive to it, and they'll put up barriers of some sort to protect customer information. And so while it can be an issue, I don't think it will be the primary issue. A few customers may be sensitive, but in general, I think it won't be the most important barrier to Intel getting key customers.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I don't think Intel will be able to land AMD as a customer, but, you know, Intel did get out of the modem business, right? So they're not competing with Qualcomm anymore. And Qualcomm is one of the largest fabless semiconductor companies. So they certainly have a shot at that. You know, maybe not a GPU vendor because they have GPUs, but there are so many more companies out there that clearly do not compete with Intel. So I think they'll have a better shot at it than maybe even Samsung. So let's just talk about the strength of TSMC and Samsung in the foundry business. You know, what do you have to say about TSMC versus Samsung and now versus Intel? You know, how are these capabilities going to line up?
Well, competing with TSMC in the foundry business is a real challenge for anyone, even Samsung. The breadth of processes that TSMC supports, the breadth of design styles, of design tools, the customer interface, the loyalty they build up over the years, the reusable intellectual property, the ability to offer very advanced technology or very mature technology. TSMC is a remarkable powerhouse. And they do it at very high profitability, almost 50% gross margins, with a heavy weighting of the profitability toward very leading edge processes, something that's also a challenge because usually new processes mean new capital equipment and lower margins, but that hasn't been the case with TSMC. Very hard to match all those capabilities, but not impossible. Certainly the very fact that they're so profitable means that there is some pricing room there. Looking down the road, while Intel is making a phenomenally large investment, $20 billion in incremental fab capacity in the coming few years, we have $100 billion from TSMC, 5-to-1. That's very hard to compete with. Now, Samsung, a different story. They've done a remarkable job of getting back in the foundry business after a lot of hesitation and withdrawal, and they've been very focused. And they are, they've adopted the same kinds of customer practices that have made TSMC great. They are flexible. They do give access to their latest technology. They do have a broad range of technologies, and they're able to support customers in many, many different types of applications as well as in assembly test. I think even there, though, they are still quite a small factor compared to TSMC. And while they're growing, they've focused on trying to bring in some very big customers, and there have been some fits and starts, but clearly they're committed, they're there to stay. So that just creates one more leading edge competitor that can offer the most advanced of processes. So they now, both Samsung and TSMC, are developing footprints in the US. Samsung's a bit ahead on that with their Austin fabs. And TSMC committed to Arizona 2024 startup. So both of them will have some footprint in the U.S., but I think that's a strength that Intel has that they won't have. That is, Intel will have its primary process development and infrastructure in the U.S. The others will probably not.
Yeah, you mentioned the CapEx. I mean, I think this is probably the most CapEx and the biggest CapEx increase we've ever seen in the industry, you know, with Intel and TSMC and Samsung all committing, you know, so many billions of dollars for additional fabs and equipment and capabilities. I mean, well, doesn't this seem like maybe an oversupply is coming? I mean, and right now we're in the grips of shortages, or, you know, the narrative is, oh, we're shortages, there are shortages. But, you know, last year we had a drop in utilization. So this year, you know, we're trying to make up for it. But I mean, is there going to be an overcapacity issue with all these fabs being built and with Intel, TSMC, and Samsung, you know, competing against each other?
Well, yeah, we always have some level of idle capacity or shortage of capacity. That's been the history of the industry. It's just that now we've gotten down to a limited number of very large foundries. So that tends to smooth it, because when some customers are in periods of high demand, other customers are not. And there's some balance there. But yeah, you're probably right. You can't bring on that much capacity without overshooting at some level, and you make up for that as best you can. But look at the history. There has been a buffer of unused capacity, and the thing that makes the current environment different is that the mature capacity is all full. Normally, The leading edge capacity is full, but more mature capacity has lots of flexibility. Right now, we're in a period where all capacity is nearly fully booked, and that's a little bit different. But I don't think I would look for a massive oversupply, but certainly there can be oversupply, and that leads to reduced pricing, and that's okay. You know, that helps the customers, and these companies aren't going to be so severely hit that they go out of business. And with that kind of capital investment, they're going to have enormous cash flow.
Yeah, I mean, have you heard of panic buying? You know, is there panic buying in the chip industry right now? You know, I remember when, you know, COVID started. I mean, if I look in my garage, I have probably a year's worth of toilet paper, thanks to my wife. You know, are people hoarding chips? I mean, that's what I'm hearing in the supply chain.
Yeah, this is also a part of the history of the semiconductor industry. The sport is double ordering. And there's really no penalty for double ordering and then canceling when you start to get delivery. So that's what people do. And I hear the assurances every time we go into a cycle like this that the semiconductor companies are really forcing discipline on their customers, asking them to certify that they're not double ordering the same order and so on. But it happens. And so that exaggerates the excess when it finally does occur, because all of a sudden then the different suppliers are able to provide the product at the same time, and the customers don't need it all, so they begin canceling the orders, and that leads to problems. I'm sure we're seeing that now because the shortages are very severe. And I can assure you, when an automotive company is short of chips, their people do not give you, a semiconductor manufacturer, a moment of calm and patience. They are on you at all times because they've got cars piling up in the lot, and they've got employees laid off, and they have capital investments that are not being productive. It's a very serious situation when you get in a shortage like we're in now. And so you do everything you can. And one of those things is to place orders with anyone you think may have capacity that will open up sooner than someone else.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is the car companies are a good example. You know, a lot of the car companies are saying, oh, we're going to have shortages, shortages, shortages. But some of them aren't. You know, Toyota just came out with huge numbers, you know, for the first quarter. And, you know, I was told privately that Toyota has a much better managed supply chain. And, you know, they didn't get caught short because of how they do business, whereas some of the other, in fact, U.S. companies, they're now caught short and you know, are crying shorter numbers and restating their financials, right?
Yeah, that's a very interesting conundrum, because many articles are showing saying that Kanban was the problem. Just-in-time inventory is what has led to this problem. The future is going to be bigger inventories, bigger stockpiles. And yet here you have the king of Kanban and just-in-time, Toyota, you know, suddenly is less affected than others. Makes you think that there are ways to run just-in-time where you protect yourself in some way. At any rate, it's interesting that they should be one that's held up as being less affected than other automotive suppliers.
Yeah. Well, we'll see how the numbers continue in the next couple quarters. So you mentioned the fabs in Arizona and Austin. Let's go back to that. So Wally, what is the impact of TSMC's Arizona fabs? I mean, it's kind of interesting that TSMC coming to the U.S. for one, you know, which they haven't in the past, because they get such a good deal on land and other financial incentives from the Taiwanese government. You know, that they really are good partners with the Taiwanese government. So now TSMC is coming to the U.S. and not just with a token fab, which is what I thought it was, but now they're saying they're going to build four fabs, and right in Arizona, right next to Intel. I mean, is that a coincidence?
Well, there are certainly reasons why you want a fab near other fabs. The infrastructure is very difficult to reproduce. Now, it's a well-kept secret that TSMC had production capacity in the U.S. way back in Washington State. Subcritical, small size, inefficient, money-losing, but they had a footprint in the U.S., probably because they had some early customers who wanted that assurance. But this one, as you say, is for real. Why do you want it there, and why do you want it next to other fab people? Well, just the ability to get clean gases, chemicals, and water, to have suppliers, to have technicians, to have all the things you need to keep a fab going, you need scale. And the thing that makes the Taiwanese fabs in Hsinchu so effective is that if you have an Applied 5000 piece of equipment go down at 3 a.m., you've got a dozen technicians who can take it apart and repair it with great skill. And if you had your fab spread over many different sites, you wouldn't have that level of redundancy and support. And the same thing is true. I was at TI for 21 years, and we would build fabs when countries gave us subsidies, and they would work okay. The Italy fab was an example. It ran okay for a while, and then all of a sudden you would get a load of chemicals that instead of being 4/9 pure was 2/9 pure, and all of a sudden you're scrapping everything in the fab. So I respect their choice of a site where there is already infrastructure, and I'm sure that Arizona has been quite cooperative in helping semiconductor manufacturing grow there. It's the home of Motorola, the early capabilities, and so probably a very good location for them.
Yeah, I agree. There's a lot of fab experience there. So let's talk about Biden's proposed $50 billion funding for the semiconductor industry. I mean, you know, I'm happy to see it. It's nice that politicians are talking about semiconductors, right? It's been a long time. But how effective is that going to be? And is Intel in line for some of that money?
Oh, I would say they're definitely in line. They are probably the prime recipient. Now, it's unfortunate that kind of program will have to be heavily influenced by politics, because the smart thing to do, of course, would be provide incentives to people like TSMC and Samsung to put real process development in place in the U.S. and build infrastructure and have a capability so that if something does happen to our supply lines, if China puts a blockade around Taiwan or something, you can continue to function effectively in the U.S. You have the other skills needed to develop new processes or to have the most advanced leading edge processes. So I doubt that the U.S. government can be politically capable and still make the money available to foreign corporations. That's unfortunate, but that's good for Intel. So between Intel, GlobalFoundries, possibly a handful of others, that's where you have a reasonable leading edge capability. And actually, Intel's is the most leading edge of the U.S. ones. We do have the fabs in New York, but I think they stand to benefit greatly. And I just hope they can develop the skills needed to run a foundry, which, as we said before, is not really in their DNA and will be a new skill. I suspect they are going to, because I think they know this, I think they're going to set it up in such a way that it can operate independent of many of the restrictions that you have in traditional IDM manufacturing at a company like Intel.
Yeah, but you know, Wally, building a fab is one thing, and that's great. That's a good, foot in the door. But, you know, what about the mask shops? What about the packaging? There's a huge ecosystem or supply chain that goes, along with the making of these chips. You know, one fab or four fabs, you know, that doesn't get you the whole thing we need to bring semiconductor manufacturing in the United States.
You're absolutely right. And that is something where even Intel uses offshore sites around the world, particularly Malaysia and Korea and other places for most semiconductor companies. And that is extremely difficult to rebuild. In my years at TI, we always had people lobbying to get local assembly capability, and yet we never were able to do that cost effectively. We didn't have the scale, and there's a whole third-party industry that has enormous capacity and investment, and it is offshore. It is not in the U.S., and $50 billion doesn't come close to scratching that capability. So I think you'll still have dependence. But I think what the politicians are most worried about, and probably should be, is China. I don't think they're as worried about losing Malaysia or losing other parts of the world. But Taiwan and China seem to be the places that are at most risk. So I think we will have to count upon continuing to get substantial portions of our assembly and test capability manufactured offshore.
Yeah, because, you know, right now a design goes to, maybe it's done in the US, it goes to Taiwan or Korea, master made, then the masks are shipped to the fabs in the US, and then the dies are shipped to someplace else for packaging. It is a very complicated supply chain, and I don't know, it just seems, it just doesn't seem possible for the United States to cut and paste, this whole thing over into Arizona or wherever. But anyway, so, let's move on to Intel and their foundry push. So in the past, Intel's been very secretive about their design rules. In fact, I don't know if you remember, but you remember when Intel bought Altera? I actually worked with Altera, and when Altera went to use Intel fabs, and they were owned by Intel this time, they got design rule decks that were redacted. I mean, it was the funniest thing. They're part of Intel, but they would not give them access to the full design rules and the process recipes. And that's part of Intel's competitive advantage, I guess. But in the foundry business, I mean, you kind of have to be more collaborative. You kind of have to have an open kimono. Is Intel going to be able to do that?
That's an awfully big change. I've heard the same things you have, where designers of chips didn't even have full visibility into the design rules until the process was essentially released. I think the great history of TSMC that's sometimes forgotten is it was its openness with design rules that caused it to gain the lead. When Don Brooks was president, he set that as his goal. He said, I spend most of my time trying to figure out how to manufacture products that were designed to be manufactured somewhere else. I want everybody else to have to struggle to produce products that were designed to be built at TSMC. So at the 1 micron level of processes, he became very open. Before that, you had to sign very rigid non-disclosure agreements with all the foundries if you wanted to get their design rules. And he basically became so open that VLSI Technology, that had their passport library, just decided to base all of their processes on TSMC as a uniform standard, and everyone else would be a variant that was compared to that standard. Intel's certainly not in that space. Intel certainly has been secretive. That's not new to the semiconductor industry. When I was at TI, they were very secretive, and we thought there was good reason when we were a leader, and then when we ceased to be a leader, we were embarrassed to tell people our process, so we still remain secretive. But I think some things like Sematech and other consortia sort of allowed things to leak out more, but Intel kept maintained that secrecy, and maybe they can do that for their own processors, their own microprocessors and other products, and then have a separate design rule flow for the foundries. That's possibly a way where they can be more open. Personally, if I were running it, I would consider, why not set up the foundry so that you can accept TSMC design rules for at least a mainstream set of the processes, so that people can test you out as an alternate source from existing designs they have at TSMC or Samsung. And that's a way to get started. You have to be flexible. In order to support the designs elsewhere, you have to reproduce the process exactly. But at least that would be a way to make the transition to the openness you need. It would be a way to get initial volume. It would be a way to demonstrate your capability. So I think that's a tempting alternative for them.
Yeah, I mean, that's how TSMC got started in the business. They were open, and you could take a GDS from TSMC to UMC to SMIC to Charter and then GlobalFoundries. But that kind of changed to FinFETs, right? TSMC is much more secretive. So, but if they could cut a deal with TSMC, boy, that would be something big. But let's talk about the ecosystem. I mean, that brings us all to it. TSMC's got a huge ecosystem that they built over the last 30 years, and you were part of it. We're actively part of it. It is a huge undertaking, and it's something that has evolved, and it's really a force of nature. How is Intel going to manage this? I mean, some of the other foundries that didn't have the ecosystem definitely have struggled, and Samsung has done a good job of putting together their own ecosystem, but it's an expensive venture, and it takes a lot of time. How's Intel going to kickstart that? EDA tools, IP, how's that going to work, Wally?
Yeah, that's a real challenge. So I think one thing that may not be as broadly recognized is the fact that when Intel tried to be in the foundry business before, they started with the same design tool flows that they used in their own manufacturing processes. Well, not everyone uses those. In fact, Intel was a bit of an outlier in some areas. And so customers who had a particular design flow that was well entrenched found that Intel would not support the design tool flow they had, and it took a long time for tool vendors to qualify their tools, and it never got very far. So a lot of customers couldn't use the foundry because they just didn't have a compatible way to deal with it. And the IP is another incredibly difficult issue. To qualify IP to run on a particular process in a particular foundry requires running wafers, qualifying them, and that's taken decades now to build up the kind of library that supports Intel today and now increasingly Samsung, SMIC, and others. But that's an enormous competitive barrier that TSMC has that Intel would have to invest a great deal of effort, money, and other activity to support. Now, they do have a lot of design wear, or more correctly, a lot of design libraries and IP for basic building blocks that they can probably utilize and provide to customers. But it's that third-party infrastructure, all the thousands of little companies that, when they design a creative, helpful piece of design IP, they first release it to TSMC because that's the biggest market, and then they choose another foundry, maybe Samsung. It's going to take them a while to get down the list to Intel, so you sort of have to bribe them. You have to give them financial incentives to do that. That's costly, that's time-consuming. To get into the foundry business at this late stage of evolution, you'll have to focus on a limited number of key customers, cater to their specific needs and idiosyncrasies in terms of tools and IP, support them very well. A big challenge. I think Pat is going to have his hands full.
Yeah, but as you said, Pat's a very smart, very talented man. So if anybody can do it, I would say it would be Pat. And my feeling is, you have to look at foundries two different ways. There's a pure play foundry, which is TSMC and UMC and GlobalFoundries, and then there's the IDM foundries, right, which is Samsung and Intel, and there are a couple others. I think Intel could become the number one IDM foundry, quite quickly. I really do. But I don't think an IDM foundry is ever really going to fairly compete with a pure play foundry. I think it'd be very difficult. And I think if we just come to terms with that, they're an IDM foundry. We do need more foundries. We have to have competition. That builds, a much wider business. It builds more competitive wafer costs and et cetera. So I think it's important, and I'm fully behind it. But I think we just have to call it is for what it is. I mean, they're an IDM foundry.
Well, and they do have a market that can be captive. I would not be at all surprised if Department of Defense related businesses put restrictions that product has to be produced or at least sourced, alternate sourced in the U.S. They could capture a very large share of that business, and it's not inconsequential. They could pick some other key niches where they have reason to dedicate a lot of resource and can get reasonable volume. But I think, as you say, an IDM foundry is not like a pure play foundry, and maybe the right thing to do is to set up a subsidiary within Intel that is a pure play foundry, but that is initially granted licenses to a whole variety of technologies and capabilities that come from Intel. And presumably, you can do that with the help of the US government.
Yeah, it's certainly a possibility. I agree with the U.S. government angle. That would give them a huge advantage above and beyond because, the foundry business, usually when it comes to it, cost is always very important, the most important. And, that's why Samsung has done so well is they are the cost leader. The Samsung wafers are significantly less expensive than TSMC, and TSMC is going to be significantly less expensive than Intel. So, I think something like the government business, that would not make a big difference, right? But it's just something that we all have to think about. Great discussion, Wally. Thank you very much for your time. We'll see how this plays out.
I hope they're successful. It would be really great to have capability at the leading edge in the U.S., and certainly it would reduce a lot of the risk we have today, as relations are not that good with China, and China is certainly becoming more bold. Having so much of our economy tied to the island of Taiwan certainly makes a lot of people nervous. It would just be nice to have alternative sources.
I agree. Okay, well, this is a good place to stop. Thank you again, Wally, for your time, and thank you to all the listeners who tuned in, and we'll see you next week. That concludes our podcast. Thank you all for listening, and have a great day.